The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the weekly Dharma series.
So I'm going to offer a few reflections, and then, as I said earlier, hopefully we'll have a chance to have a conversation. They say there's really only one Dharma talk, and that's letting go. I don't know if that's true or not. I've heard a lot of Dharma talks. And what I've discovered is, just hearing it in different ways is so helpful. Sometimes it'll sink in. I'll say, oh, yeah, that's my experience. And then other times it's just a disconnect. So, I hope that what I have to say tonight is of some interest. If it's not, just take it with a grain of salt and keep listening. Maybe you'll find teachers that appeal. So, so I've been practicing for a long time. Seems like a long time. And in a lot of different traditions. So start out with Zen, and I've done some Tibetan practice and insight practice, which is what we do here. And I like it all. So tonight I don't think I'm not drawing on any of the... Sometimes I draw on some Tibetan teachers tonight. I'm not going to do that, but I recommend it if it interests you. Is my voice still all right? Okay. I'm also old, so I like to have things that I can refer to so I don't stray away from what I want to say. So I hope it's not distracting to you if I'm reading a little bit. So I mentioned earlier that what I want to talk about is something called the second factor of awakening. If you're not familiar with Buddhism, you won't know that there are all these lists. I mean, there's lists all over the place. And I guess it was one way that people could remember when it was an oral tradition. And the seven factors of awakening is one of those lists, and it's one of the very important teachings in Buddhism. I'm not going to go into the whole scheme in a great detail. I'm really focusing on the second factor of curiosity and why I think that's important. And Gabe always asks me for a title for these things, and so my title is Knowing What's What. And I'm going to, actually, that's a quote from somebody. I'm going to refer to it later. So a few years ago, in the midst of the worst of the COVID epidemic, a friend and I were talking about all of the stuff that life was throwing at us. And she had just lost her partner of 25 years to an autoimmune disorder that probably could have been managed had it not been COVID, but he couldn't get the treatment that he needed, and so he passed away. And she was working with a counselor at the time, and this person posed a really interesting question to her, which was, how do you handle hardship? How do you handle hardship? And what I had a lot of thoughts about it, but one of the things that struck me was that hardship was such an interesting word. I don't think I had used it myself in years, if ever. And yet it seemed so, such a precise description of what we were both experiencing. So I looked it up in the Cambridge English Dictionary, and it defined it as a condition of life that causes difficulty or suffering. So hardship is a condition that causes suffering, period. And it sounded very much like the First Noble Truth, if you're aware of what that is, the Four Noble Truths being kind of the foundational teaching of Buddhism. The First Noble Truth being there is suffering. So hardship is some of that suffering. And what I especially loved about the word hardship was that it is so absent of any sort of judgment. It's just this statement of fact. And because there's no judgment in it, then it opens up a range of possibilities for how we might respond. So the question was, how do you handle hardship? And it could be anything. And so, the way that the question was posed and the fact that hardship is just so unjudgmental invites curiosity and invites us to think, well, how do I handle hardship? And I was reminded of the importance of that curiosity and that question recently when I started my visits of what are euphemistically called senior residences, some people used to call old people's homes, or my partner and I call it the home. So when we're going to the home. But anyways, I am starting the process of looking at what will be the next phase of my life if I live that long. And it's been quite an eye-opener to go to these places. First, there's the sticker shock. If you've looked at what some of these senior residences cost, you'd be astounded. But there, for me, there was also the uncomfortable truth that I too am an old person, and that I too may be in a wheelchair or bent over a walker in the not too distant future. And so it was a wonderful opportunity, I guess you could call it that, for reflection, and also a wonderful motivation for this practice. So I was reminded of the story of the Buddha. You probably know it. So the Buddha was, when the Buddha was born, he was actually Siddhartha at the time. He was not the Buddha yet, but his father was told that he would either be a great world leader or he would be a spiritual leader, perhaps an ascetic. And his father wanted him to be the world leader. And so he did all he could do to protect him from the realities of life. And so he, thinking that maybe if he actually saw the way the world was, he might go the spiritual route. So he lived in it's said that he lived in a palace, and he was well taken care of in all regards, and really was not exposed at all to what the world was like outside of this palace. And one night he snuck out, and he was confronted by what are called the heavenly messengers, which are old age, sickness, and death. So he saw an old person, and he saw a sick person, and he saw a dead person, and he was like totally shocked. He didn't know these kinds of things happened. And it was his wake-up call, if you will. And he saw that this too awaited him. And so he started on this journey of discovery to liberate his mind. And that was the beginning of his path and perhaps our path. So I felt a little bit like, I felt a little bit like Siddhartha, like, wow, okay, this is, here we are. This could be me. So I was a little discombobulated, I guess, by the experience. I like that word, discombobulated. I was telling a friend about this, about how I felt this sense of unease. Maybe it was the same way Siddhartha felt, I don't know. And I described it as a feeling of being in what I'm calling a liminal space, so that transition space between one thing and the next. So for me, it felt like I was making a transition, or beginning the transition, from what has been a very healthy old middle age, late middle age, to this unknown next phase of my life. And it felt very frightening and destabilizing, because as human beings, I think we like certainty. We like to know what's going on and what we can expect. And this didn't feel that way. So my friend asked a very interesting question of me, which was, where do you find refuge? Where do you find refuge? Again, it's such an interesting question because it's so absent of judgment or the need to fix it. Like, what are you going to do about it? It was just, where do you find refuge? And it kind of stopped me in my tracks. I hadn't heard a question like that. I mean, the traditional refuges in Buddhism are the Dharma, the teachings, the Sangha, the community of practitioners and followers, and the Buddha or the awakened ones. But that wasn't what came to my mind. And what also didn't come to my mind are the things that I personally think of as refuge. So being in nature, being with friends, going to interesting places, used to be backpacking, I love to backpack, meditation retreats, I do a lot of meditation retreats. None of those things came up in response to this question. But what came up was curiosity. I have no idea where that came from. But it maybe because I've listened to a million Dharma talks, it actually sunk in. And curiosity was what came to me as the answer to where do I find refuge. So it felt like that was the antidote to all of the rumination and the worrying about what's going to happen next, the catastrophizing, oh my God, I'm going to be like that person in a wheelchair. It was curiosity that I realized was going to lead to less suffering in my own life, not more. So I'll talk a little bit about curiosity as the second factor of awakening. And maybe it occurred also because I'm taking an online course with the Venerable Anālio, and he's been talking about curiosity a lot. So I think it got in. So as I said, the seven factors of awakening are qualities of mind that are said to be anti-hindrances. So I'm going to try to keep the lingo to a minimum here. But so the hindrances in Buddhism are the things that keep us in delusion, that cloud our minds. And they are attachment to sensual pleasure, desire, aversion, so not liking things. See if I can get them all right. Restlessness, anxiety, sloth. I love this, sloth and torpor. Or this not having energy. And the last one is doubt. Doubt is said to be the most difficult of the hindrances. We probably all have experienced one or more of these. Has anybody here not experienced any of these? We all have them. They're part of being human. And so we need to work with them. And one of the things that we can do to work with them is to cultivate these things called the seven factors of awakening. They counteract these hindrances and keep us on track. So I kind of think of the seven factors as a kind of medicine for the mind. If the hindrances are the disease or the illness, the seven factors are the medicine. And I thought that was such a clever idea that I'd had. And then I went to a retreat here yesterday. Was it yesterday? Yes. And in fact, the Buddha called them medicine for the mind, so I must have heard that somewhere too. But anyways, the seven factors are mindfulness. So we were practicing mindfulness earlier. Investigation or curiosity is the second one. Energy, or the energy to keep practicing, is the third one. Joy is the fourth. Tranquility, the fifth. Concentration, the sixth, and the last one is equanimity. And they work together, and they balance each other. So the first ones are called the enlivening factors, energy, interest, joy, curiosity. They are enlivening. They bring the energy up. And the others are called the tranquil or the calming factors. So they balance each other. And in any moment, we can assess kind of where we are with these factors and think to ourselves, wow, I'm falling asleep here in this meditation session. Maybe I need to bring up a little more energy, a little more curiosity. Or maybe we're feeling very restless and anxious and distracted, and we might need to call on the factors of tranquility and concentration. So they balance each other out. So I'll take a breath here. So Joseph Goldstein, who's kind of one of the senior teachers in this tradition, maybe you've heard of him. He was one of those people that went to India back in the 70s and came back on fire and founded one of the biggest meditation centers in this tradition in Massachusetts. And he wrote a book called Mindfulness. It's about this thick. And actually, I haven't read it. But I took it out the other day and I started reading what he was saying about the seven factors. And he talked about the second factor of curiosity as knowing what's what. That's very succinct. And he goes on to say, one function of mindfulness is remembering and calling to mind what is skillful and what is not. So skillful in this tradition means what causes, what promotes happiness, contentment, freedom. And what is not skillful is the opposite of that. So mindfulness is remembering and calling to mind what is skillful and what is not. Mindfulness brings us face to face with these arising states. The wisdom factor of investigation or curiosity then illuminates the states themselves and discerns the difference between the two. This is not an academic exercise. The wisdom factor in our minds is like an investigative reporter who digs deep to get to the bottom of things. In this case, understanding the very causes of our suffering and their end. So it's the wisdom factor, curiosity, that allows us to really understand what's going on with us beneath all the stories and determine what is going to lead to more suffering and what is going to lead to less. So using my example of my experience in the senior residences, although I was somewhat aware of the fact that I was experiencing a lot of aversion, a lot of fear, a lot of uncertainty, I think I lacked enough mindfulness, that first factor, to really connect with my body and disengage from all those thoughts that were going on in my mind about how bad it was going to be. And so I was kind of stuck in my rut, in my stories. But had I remembered that I might call on this refuge of curiosity, I might have asked myself the following questions. So the first one is, what am I experiencing right now? And what does that feel like in the body? So I knew I was kind of freaked out, but I don't think I had any idea what was going on beneath my head. So what does it feel like in the body? What stories am I telling myself? And how do they make me feel? Can I let them go and come back to just being right here, right now in this body? And then what happens when I do? So it's an investigation about what is leading to my suffering, to my state of aversion, fear, whatever, and what would it be like if I did something different? And when I thought about that later, I realized that a lot of my suffering at being confronted with old age, sickness, and death was because I had made it about me. I'm gonna be one of these people. I'm gonna be in a wheelchair, whatever I was thinking. And that left me feeling very lonely and kind of afraid. It was a hard place to feel so vulnerable. It was all my story. I don't think I was even thinking about the other people that I was seeing. And yet, old age, sickness, and death, as the Buddha realized when he went out from his palace, that's a part of being human. It's a part of having a human body. It's all of our experience. And it's actually what connects us one to another. The fact that I'm going to be there and these people were there, that brings us together. It doesn't separate us. And it helps to cultivate compassion and kindness, both for ourselves and for others. And that's a much preferable state of mind to being freaked out, let me tell you. So being curious post-hoc after the event, I had forgotten to be curious in the moment, but being curious later about my experience in the senior residence helped me to see that my suffering was created by my taking it all so personally, and that there really was an alternative, and that alternative was this joy of connection and an open heart. So curiosity in this framework of the seven factors of awakening or enlightening, curiosity is said to lead to the next factor, which is energy, or kind of a renewed interest, which then leads to joy. And it's not a joy in stuff, but it's a joy in these qualities of mind, in the what are called the unworldly pleasures, kindness, compassion, peace of mind. It leads to a joy that is really beyond words, I guess is what I would say. And I would just say, check it out for yourself. I think in my experience, it's true. So I'm going to use some really old technology here. Does anybody know what this is? This is a CD player. I actually own one. And I want to end with playing a song that I heard on a long retreat at Spirit Rock with James Barras, who's a wonderful teacher. And one of his students wrote a musical, is not the right word. It was a play with song. About the heavenly messengers, this old age, sickness, and death. And the fourth messenger was an ascetic, a spiritual seeker who was joyful. And so this is a play with music about the what's called the fourth messenger. And there's it was written by one of James Barras' students. And there's an absolutely beautiful song in here. Most of it I actually, frankly, don't care for, but the song that he played on the retreat just like blew my mind. After, you know, a month of sitting in silence, to hear this was amazing. So I am going to attempt to play this, and I would just invite you to listen to it. I've noticed that you can't hear very well the first word in the song. So the first word in the song is cancer. And it's the song of being sung by two women. One is the woman who's just been diagnosed with cancer. And the second woman is somebody called Mama Sid. So it is the female Siddhartha, the female Buddha, who is working with this young woman who's been diagnosed with cancer to be curious about her situation. So let's hope this works.
That's nice. Oh, you can read something, so I
there we go.
I'm so afraid.
See if you, I see the fear.
What color is it?
White.
What shape?
Blinding.
I
like sun on the snow.
Yes.
Breathe through the fear. I'm trying to breathe through the fear, but how can I breathe through the fear?
That's a beautiful expression of what I was trying to say. Sometimes, for me anyways, music gets in the heart in a different way. So we have some time to open it up. I would love to hear your own experience of curiosity or what you find refuge in, how you handle hardship. Any of those questions that were posed to me. And I'll just open it up if you'd like to share something or any reaction to anything that I said.
For me, two things. Number one, be friends or other people. Always reaching out to other people, and that's very important for me. And also the second one is, we just heard, is music. That's the text, but you've got the accompaniment, the melody, and I have to say that last one sounded like it was from Wicked.
I'm sorry?
It sounded like it was from Wicked.
Oh.
And but I really like the I like focusing on the main singers, but then I also like focusing on the accompaniment that's going on with it and everything like that. So it gets your mind off of what's troubling you.
It's troubling you, yeah. Thank you. Have experience with curiosity?
Yeah, I just have a question.
Sure.
I've never heard of curiosity referred to as a refuge. I was wondering if you talked a little more about why it's a refuge does it give you energy to move forward, or what?
Sure. So the question was, why is curiosity a refuge for me? I think because it unhooks me from whatever story I'm caught in, and allows me to come to the question, the truth of that, and see it also in a larger context, instead of just believing whatever my mind is saying to me. And I can learn things that maybe I don't see when I'm caught in whatever hindrance I'm caught in. So it just, I guess it opens up the, as you were talking about music, it opens up the lens to see what else is true. And in the case of my experience at the senior residences, it was seeing the truth that I'm no different than everyone there, and actually that's the point of connection. It's a point of a joy, actually, instead of suffering. Yeah, does that? Yeah. And what's your experience with curiosity or hardship? What do you find helpful? If I can put you on the spot.
Well, I was just thinking the alternative is to be stuck where you are. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah.
But also, the things I'm curious about aren't always good for me either, so.
So you have to discern what causes suffering and what leads to less suffering. Yeah. Yeah, so everybody here, Kevin, yeah. Sometimes the things he's curious about are not always skillful, or whatever the word is you'd use. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you for your reflections. I completely agree about your curiosity being enlivening. However, there is, at least in my experience, there is sometimes a risk of if it's not embodied, like you said, it can take the form of like, I have a problem and I need to find the root cause and fix it. Mm-hmm. And it's very mental, and in my case, it usually goes into rumination and sometimes like, why have this mood? And it just becomes like a never ending, like, oh, because I did this or this person did that, whatever. It's just like, you can get into a dead end or even make it worse for you. So yeah, just to say that the embodied part is huge. Otherwise, for me, it's very easy to just get lost.
Yes.
Yeah.
Good point. Thank you. Somebody once said to me, you know, never to ask the question why, ask the question what. Mm-hmm. What's happening? And stay out of that, to stay out of that fix-it mode. Or why me? Or, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Don't try to find the cause.
Right.
Just stay with what is happening.
What is happening, yes. Okay. Knowing what is happening.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, the embodiment is key. Yeah. Thank you.
So in connection to what you said, you know, like, I don't know if this is a question or a comment, but it's like as you mentioned, curious of what, like, as to why I'm doing it. And I start to realize, okay, is it because of trauma? Is it because of, like, I'm taught this way and so forth? But then the more I keep digging, it's like, the end is, there's only two words came up, human nature. So I guess it's more like a comment than a question, I guess.
Yeah, human nature. That's right, it's not personal.
Exactly.
Yeah. When somebody said that to me once, it was like, what? You know, it was so freeing. It's not personal. Yeah.
Exactly.
The result of causes and conditions, only some of which we know. Yeah. Thank you.
I think when you said ask what and not, just how, why, I guess.
Why?
I find it really helpful to, like, when I do ask myself what, often the answer is the same, like the same, it's the same feeling or it's the same kind of ruminating, and I find having that curiosity can actually lend itself to this moment of like levity, almost like, ha, like, oh, there you go again, oh, there you go again, oh, that's so silly, kind of, or just funny how like it's in my nature just to keep doing that. And it's almost, I don't know, often the curiosity to me lends levity, which is nice.
Thank you. So it sounds like there's a little distance between you and whatever it is you're dealing with. You're able to see it from a different perspective. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's some joy in it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you.
Lately, I've noticed my biggest form of curiosity is especially I was recently reading the Diamond Sutra, and a big thing that they talk about, and Ramana the Buddha talks about in that one, is how he differentiates that all these things that he's teaching, he wants people to remember that they're simply, at the end of the day, concepts. They're merely tools to get to the truth. They are not the truth in and of themselves. And as people, we tend to, unfortunately, our intellect, which as great as it can be, is sometimes the most misleading thing ever. And we get stuck on thinking that, oh my goodness, that I've got to fathom this. It's like, no. It's not within the mind, it's in the experience of it that you have to understand it. And so I guess my curiosity has driven me to want to make sense of that more in the experiential forms of all these teachings that come through. And I found every time I look back on moments where it actually impacted, where I realized, oh my goodness, I have experienced that. It's not something foreign whatsoever. Sometimes you just don't know because you're completely just in the moment. You're just a part of the situation with other people.
Right.
And it's devoid of the self.
Right.
But as I've noticed, that's where curiosity has shown up, especially for models, is getting past the concepts.
Uh-huh.
Just like, what is the real experience then?
Right. Beautiful. Thank you.
I was in Kamsunai in the at home. I had gotten quite irritable, and because a dear one had been saying some pretty irritating things. And being irritable, I was sort of thinking about not coming in because he wants to do this when they're irritable. I guess.
It's the best time.
And, yeah. Jeez, that's fine. It was interesting to be holding the thought, I don't wish to be irritable, I'd like to get rid of that. And also holding the thought, no, I want to accept this irritability. And then to hear you encourage us to be curious and to let go of both of those and say, well, what is this irritability? I'm still irritable, but I'm glad I came because it gave me this opportunity to explore this irritability. And I think, as you suggested, created a little distance, allowed me to look at this. And during the meditation, to be able to clearly say, oh, right, this irritability is me constructing a me that's really unhappy about a thing that transpired. And, you can see it. Given the opportunity to just calmly look at it and ask this question, you can see it. It was really sweet. So, Thank you.
Hi.
I like that question a lot, like, distinguishing between, like, focusing on what instead of why? What would be the follow-up question for what? Because I was thinking about that myself and, like, trying to understand some habit of the mind, but I feel like it's really easy then to slip back into, like, when I get into what it is, to try and then to, well, what's the root of it? So, like, how do you get, yeah, like, what's the follow-up question for what that is leading in the direction of curiosity, but not in, like, a figuring out?
Well, I think there was a mention of the embodied experience. Mm-hmm. I think coming back to the body is a good way to disengage from that desire to want to know why, mm-hmm. and sneaking around that, trying to find another way into the answer to that. So, you know, the body doesn't lie. The body is just here in this moment. So that would be one suggestion I might have, is when you see yourself trying to find another way to get the answer, just come back to the body. What's here now? Let's see what happens.
I don't really know if this question makes sense, but I'm just kind of confused about, I'm really new to this meditating thing, and I guess I don't know, it might kind of be similar to your question, like, I don't know what I'm supposed to be thinking about when I meditate, because you're supposed to be thinking about nothing, maybe, but when you do have thoughts, you're supposed to acknowledge them and then, like, let them go. But I'm just confused about, like, when these, like, big things might come up, like, oh, wow, like, I haven't thought about that big issue in a while, and it just came up, like, I really want to think about it and solve it. I'm scared I'm going to forget I even thought this, so I want to think about it right now. Like,
anybody else have that experience?
Like, every single time I meditate, all my thoughts seem like, oh God, I have to think about this right now or I'm going to forget.
Mm-hmm.
So I just feel like I'm doing it wrong. And then I know, like, ooh, be nice to myself, self-acceptance, non-judgmental. But it's so, like, it's so unstructured that don't know what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm. So I would say it does sound like you know what you're doing. You're aware of what's going on in your mind. So that's what we're doing. And I don't think there's probably not a person in this room who doesn't have a thought while they're meditating. Does anybody here not think? I mean, the mind thinks, right? So the idea that there aren't going to be, there are some forms of meditation, deep absorptions, where actually the thoughts slow down so much that I've never been in one of these, but it's said that there's not thinking going on. And that has a role, but that's not what we're doing in this space tonight. It's observing what our experience is. And so you were observing the mind thinking, the mind thinks. And if you choose to not follow the thought, again, it's your choice, and then you can direct your attention to something else other than the thinking, and oftentimes a useful thing is the breath, right, because we're always breathing, or the feet on the ground, or the bottom in the chair, where whatever is, I would say, tactile is the easy thing to focus on, to redirect your attention away from the thoughts. And probably everybody here is also worried that if I don't write this down or follow this thought now, you know, it's going to be gone and this is really important. I need to figure it out now. Well, I mean, you could. Again, that's your choice. Or you could just trust that if it's important enough, it'll show up again. That's my experience anyways. Others could speak to their experience. And you could say to yourself, not now, I'm not doing this now, well, I'll get back to you later, or whatever you choose, however you choose to address it, and then see if you can redirect your attention elsewhere. But especially when you first start meditating, it seems like, oh, all this important stuff is going through my mind, I've got to pay attention to this. And after a while, you'll realize that it's really not all that important. And if you need to remember it, you will remember it. It'll come up in other contexts. So thinking happens. And the thing to do is to notice that it's happening, which you did notice. You noticed that. And you noticed the pull to want to figure it out. That's also good noticing. And then you can choose then what you want to do next. And one thing you could do next is to redirect your attention to an object, such as the breath, until the mind calms down a little bit. And then it'll be pulled off again, and you notice that, and then you come back. It's not a problem. Does that help?
Yes, it does. It's just a very unfamiliar thing to me.
Uh-huh.
So I want, rules and, I want it to be just do this. But it's
yeah.
not that simple.
Yeah. Has anybody found it simple? I mean, this is hard work. We're not conditioned this way. We're not educated this way. So you're really changing, a lifetime of patterns.
Another thing is to realize that it takes time. Mm-hmm. There's that old saying of the Buddhist meditation master who gets up in front of his student and points here to the calluses.
Right.
It took a long time to get it, and for each meditation session, it takes minutes at least before the mind calms down. So you can have the intention to sit for 30 minutes, and you might take 15 minutes of that just trying to calm the mind down and constantly coming back to the breath.
Right.
It takes time.
Yes. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think what we're trying to do is normalize your experience. It's common. It's part of the human experience. That is what our minds do. And it's not a bad thing to be thinking. It's just we might want to be doing something else while we're meditating, which is to try to calm the mind by focusing on it.
Because we're human doings,
right?
Not human beings,
right?
Right.
Thank you. Yeah, there's one more over here. And I think this will be the last, and then it's almost 8:30. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess I was just thinking about the idea that thoughts are a sense, and I find that to be super helpful, mm-hmm. As just another sense.
Uh huh. Yeah. Thank you. So the mind is the sixth sense door. It's just like anything, like the ears or the eyes or anything else. The mind is thinks, just as the nose smells and the eyes see. All right, I think we're almost out of time. So I wanted to read something, if I can see it, from Nisargadatta Maharaj, who wrote this in 1971. By being with yourself, by watching yourself in your daily life with alert interest, with the intention to understand rather than to judge, in full acceptance of whatever may emerge, because it is there, you encourage the deep to come to the surface and enrich your life and consciousness with its captive energies. This is the great work of awareness. It removes obstacles and releases energies by understanding the nature of life and mind. Intelligence is the door to freedom, and alert attention is the mother of intelligence. So I appreciate your engagement, I guess is the word I'm looking for, in our discussion tonight, and for your kind attention to my remarks, and and if anything that I said was hurtful or harmful to you, I hope you will forgive me and let go of whatever is not of use and whatever is. So we'll end by dedicating what's called dedicating the merits, so just recognizing that our being together here tonight and of our following the path in whatever way we do that is not only for our own benefit, but for the benefit of all beings. So this is a concluding aspiration that I'd like to read from Pema Chodron, a Tibetan practitioner, from her book, The Places That Scare You. Throughout my life until this very moment, whatever virtue I have accomplished, including any benefit that may come from this meditation and this coming together tonight, I dedicate to the welfare of all beings. May the roots of suffering diminish. May warfare, violence, neglect, indifference, and addictions also decrease. May the wisdom and compassion of all beings increase, now and in the future. May we clearly see all the barriers we erect between ourselves and others to be as insubstantial as our dreams. May we continue to open our hearts and minds in order to work ceaselessly for the benefit of all beings. May we go to the places that scare us. May we lead the life of a warrior.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.